Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today we're opening a time capsule of sorts, one that will take us back to New York City in 1977. It's a film celebrating, of all things, subway graffiti, and it has a surprising musical score. We'll hear from the filmmaker later on the show. We also have live music from Cinquain, the global dance band that'll give us the sound of modern-day New York. Now, in between the New York of the 70s and the New York of today, there were lots of other musical stories unfolding, including this one. In addition to sporting one of the most famous beards in music, Scott Ian is also a founding member of the New York band Anthrax. The thrash metal pioneer has written a new memoir called I'm the Man, the story of that guy from Anthrax. And today, Scott Ian joins me here in the studio. Hey, Scott.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. I enjoyed the way you opened the book, talking about breaking into Legends Field, the Yankees' spring training grounds in Florida. As a lifelong Yankee fan,
you understand.
And this is something people don't understand: the pain of longtime Yankee fans, because until 1976, they kind of sucked.
Yeah, and then from 82 to 95, they sucked.
Yeah,
all the Mattingly years, the Paliarulo years. People forget Butch Weiniger.
Right,
was a Yankee.
So, we both grew up in Queens as kind of outsiders because, you know, Queens was Mets territory.
Right.
But for you, I mean, the kind of analogy is that, you know, Anthrax and the Yankees both had up and down kind of years.
Yes.
For Anthrax, what were the peak years and what were the 60s, early 70s Yankee years?
I guess you could say 87 through 94 would have been the peak years. Mm-hmm. And then 95 through 2009. I mean, not all bad, but that was kind of like 95 is when it started going south. And then 2010, like the ship turned around and everything's been great since. We're where the Yankees were in 96 through 01.
Yeah.
Like that's where we're at now.
and literally because you played Yankee Stadium.
Yes, in 2011.
With Megadeth, Metallica, and Slayer. So it was like the big four thrash bands playing Yankee Stadium. What did that feel like to be out on that field?
It's one of those moments in my life where if I didn't have photos, it would be hard for me to believe it actually happened. It's still one of those things that, even leading up to it, we knew about it, I think, in April of 11 is when we first heard the rumor, because we were doing the big four out at Coachella in Los Angeles. And that's when we heard the rumor that there was going to be a New York date. Mm-hmm. And it was possibly going to be Yankee Stadium. And I said to our manager, I said, don't F with my head, man. I said, you can't tell me it's possibly going to be Yankee Stadium, because then if it's not, I'm not even going to want to do the show. And I went on record publicly saying, if the Big Four shows at Citi Field, I'm not playing it. So, and then, of course, they said, no, it's Yankee Stadium. It's a done deal. And I couldn't even wrap my head around that, because even now, it's not like it's a regular concert venue.
No,
like before the Big Four show, I think they had done Paul McCartney, Billy Joel, and the Pope, like as far as concerts go. So it was like an incredible thing leading up to it. And I have never been so agonizingly nervous before a gig. Not because of the size of the crowd, it had nothing to do with it. It was the fact that I was standing on a stage, you know, that they built out in center field where so many of my heroes, you know, had played. And it was a completely mind moment for me. I say in the book, I don't want to give too much away, but Randy Johnson was there, and someone who's been in high pressure moments in his life, especially against the Yankees.
Against the Yankees, 2001 World Series.
Yeah, of course. And I don't hold it against him. He's actually a good buddy of mine. But he was there, and he gave me some really good advice. And it's in the book. I don't want to like spoil too much, but he actually got me. He kind of got me off the ledge enough for me to get out there. And I'm telling you, man, we opened the show with our song Cotton Amash, and tears. I just the emotion that came over me, and the whole 5 minutes of that song, I had tears running down my face.
Is called I'm the Man, the story of that guy from Anthrax. And that guy is Scott Ian with me here in the Soundcheck studio. The title of the book is obviously from the song I'm the Man, which, as you detail it in the book, started as a joke.
Yeah, it is a joke. It was
a pretty serious joke, as it turned out.
Yeah, it was me and my friend John Rooney sitting in my tiny little bedroom in my mom's apartment in Bayside, messing around. We were both really into rap music and just messing around. I'm not even quite sure how it started, but I was playing the riff to Hava Nagia, the Jewish folk song thing, and we just started messing around with lyrics, talking about the guys in the band and stuff like that. And it was just funny. We were making ourselves laugh and brought it into the band. We had rehearsal not long after that and brought it in, and everybody loved the idea. So, you know, the initial idea, too, was to have the Beastie Boys on it. And this is the Beasties hadn't broken yet. License to Ill hadn't taken off. But we knew those dudes, and we asked them. We said, hey, we got this thing. It's like a crossover thing with rap and metal, and we'd love you guys to be on it. And they were like, yeah, we would love to do that. And then we went and recorded it, and we're so happy with our version. There was no room for them, you know, so it's like one of those what-if moments if we would have had them on it. But it did pretty well on its own without the Beasties on it anyway. It took off. You know, we had no idea. If anything, we thought, well, you know, our fans are probably not going to like this.
Put it on the B-side.
Yeah, and it was not just the B-side, but it was a B-side of a 12-inch single that only came out in the UK of I Am the Law. So we figured you can't really bury it more than this. So if nobody will even know that it's out, to have a chance to hate it. And it'll go away very quickly. And then it did the opposite.
Yeah. it did.
It blew up.
No!
Yo, man, what's the matter with you?
Get it the next time, I mean.
Charlie, beat the beat, the beats you beat.
The only thing hard is the smell of my feet.
Don't listen, of course you might get dissed. Don't train the lizard or take a
chair.
Man, yo. What's the beat? I'm on your case, I'm in your face.
So that is the radio edit of Anthrax's I'm the Man. You won't mind if we use that version.
No, I haven't heard like the record version of that in a really long time, because we do a version of it live it's just different. The song's evolved so much over the years, and if anything, we kind of deconstruct it even more, you know, when we do it live these days. And Charlie stays on the drums, doesn't come out front, and he just kind of goes off on all these crazy grooves, and it's like a challenge for us to follow him sometimes. It's pretty fun.
Scott Ian's with us on Soundcheck. His new book is called I'm the Man, the story of that guy from Anthrax. Anthrax's latest record is Worship Music from 2011. So will people be surprised, you know, reading this book at the range of music that you like? I mean, you know, you talk about things you listened to as a kid. Elton John was important and, you know, Kiss, of course.
Right.
And your Uncle Mitch was the one who kind of turned you on to all the bands, right?
Well, that was one specific thing. That was the first time I ever heard Black Sabbath. And that was the heaviest thing I had ever heard up until that point.
How old were you?
It had to be... he was still living at my grandparents' house. I'm going to say it was definitely early 70s because they hadn't moved to Florida yet. And I want to say they moved down there around 72 or 73. So it was early 70s. And, you know, he was only 10 years older than me, you know, which, 18 and like 8 is a big age difference.
That's a big difference.
But not like, you know, my dad's age. My Uncle Mitch is like 10 years younger than my dad, or even 13 years younger than my dad or something like that. So
so was a different generation from your dad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we'd go to my grandparents' house, and I would like hang out in Uncle Mitch's room with his blacklight posters and and vinyl and lava lamps and all that stuff. And I would flip through comic books, and he had a great comic book collection, and he had a great record collection. And you know, I would be like a kid in a candy store, and I would just look at records and ask him, "What's this? What's this? What's this?" And I remember looking at the cover of Black Sabbath and saying, "What's this?" And you know, and because it just looked spooky, and he said, "That's acid rock." And I'm like, "What's that?" And he was like, "I don't know. It's, you know, it's Black Sabbath." And I don't really know what acid rock is. I thought later on things like Frank Zappa or Captain Beefheart or things like that. But we put Black Sabbath on, and that song opens with the wind and the thunder and the rain and the bell, and Tony Iommi comes in playing the devil's the riff, the tritone, and you know, as an 8-year-old who loved horror movies, I was scared and curious at the same time. But it's not like I went right from that into looking for more things like Black Sabbath, because I still really wasn't that aware yet. Mm-hmm. Still, for me, music was, I was listening to what my parents listened to, and they listened to pretty cool stuff in the house. I mean, everything from Crosby, Stills, and Nash to Neil Diamond to Elvis to Elton John and the Doobie Brothers, lots of stuff. But Elton John for me was kind of like, that was the first thing I got into on my own. I would ask my parents to buy me the 7 inches and stuff like that. But then Kiss. Kiss was the gateway drug, really, for me. Because I didn't really rediscover Sabbath until after that. Till it got to around 77, 78, and then I really got into Sabbath.
Now, growing up as a good Jewish boy in Queens, did you realize that the guys from Kiss and that some of the Ramones were also Jewish boys from Queens making good?
I didn't know Kiss was, because that was, you know, back then you were able to maintain a level of mystery. There was no any media. There was nothing. So, you know, they were able to maintain that. They could never do that now, you know. But they were able to maintain that. So, no, I didn't know anything. I had heard about I knew who the Ramones were, and I was a fan probably from around 76, 77, I saw them for the first time on the Sha Na Na TV show, and I remember thinking, wow, those guys kick ass. Like, who are those guys? And went out and got a Ramones record, and then found out they all lived like in Forest Hills, and that was 5 miles away from me, and they wore leather jackets and Levi's, and they had long hair, and I was like, that's what I look like. I could do that, you know? But Kiss, I found out way later, you know, much later I found out that those guys, that Gene and Paul were from Queens, And then even, I don't know if this is in the book, but Gene told me a story once how after the 3 Garden shows in December of 77, they did those 3 nights, and He said every night he would go straight from the stage into the limo, and right back to his mom's house in Bayside, because Bayside of all things too.
Where
not
you,
even. Yeah. And I was like, wait, what do you mean Bayside? He goes, my mother lived on whatever street, blah blah blah. And I'm like, hold on a second, because he said that he's like, what junior high were you going to? I said IS-25, and like, what
this,
bus?
This is in the book.
Yeah.
By the
oh
way.
Yeah. He's like, what bus did you take? And I tell him, he goes, so basically. Well, you were on your bus on the way to school wearing your Kiss t-shirt that you bought, and I was sitting in my mother's kitchen drinking coffee and reading the New York Times. And I was like, wait, you mean I passed right by you? He's like, you passed right by me. I was like, oh, my God. Like, my brain exploded even then. Like, you know, I'm like 40, and my brain exploded over that little tidbit of information.
Yeah.
Gene was sitting there in Bayside the next morning while I was on the bus with all my friends who had been at the show, you know, like wearing our Kiss t-shirts.
It's a funny moment in the book where he asks what bus you took. And you know. Scott Ian's with us on Soundcheck, guitarist, co-founder of the thrash metal band Anthrax. His new memoir is called I'm the Man, the story of that guy from Anthrax. What do you remember about, you know, as you look back at, say, Fistful of Metal? I know in the book you have not very nice things to say about the cover art, but the making of, you know, what went inside the record. You know, was there a moment there where you thought, we've just taken a big step here? This song is a watershed moment for us.
On that record, yeah. You know, it's funny because I feel like if we could have had more time... Obviously, I think we could have had even a better debut album if we would have given ourselves more time to just keep writing. Because Charlie had only joined the band in like the spring of '83, and that was really the missing piece of the puzzle, was his ability on the drums and just also his sensibility that he didn't even know he had yet as a songwriter, coming in for the first time and being a part of a group like that and us working on material together. And it was such a quantum leap for us when Charlie joined. And we were in the studio only just a few months after that, in the fall of '83. So I just sometimes would think back and think, God, if we would have had 6 more months, you know, just gelling together, just what that record could have been.
So is that what the second record is? Is that the sound of the band gelling?
Absolutely.
So the next album, when you get to Spreading the Disease and you get to a song like AIR, is this like, to you, is this the sound of mature Anthrax?
Yeah, I mean...
There's those two words that sound kind of weird,
I know,
together.
Right? Anthrax is like wine. It matures. That song, we had finished recording the album. Like, we were done. All the stuff was finished. And then it was months later, because that the process of that record took a long time, because Joey joined. We had already recorded everything. And then it was a whole process of getting Joey involved. And
this is Joey Belladonna.
Yes. And we did take the time to gel with Joey. We actually left the studio for a while and went out and played shows together and really made sure he was feeling it. And and then at some point, Charlie was like, hey, I've got another song. I've got this song. It's great. Like, it has to be on the record, you know, no matter what it takes. And that meant, like, resetting up drums and the whole thing. And I was like, yeah, let's do it. So he came back up to Ithaca and we reset up and we rehearsed the song. I was like, wow, you know, it's the best song on the album in my opinion. And, you know, at the time, certainly. And it really felt like to me, certainly when we moved forward into the next record, Among the Living, that's where we were going. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm so like, it's just like, thankfully, we did stop and put that song on the record because it makes such a difference.
Let's hear a little bit of AIR from the band Anthrax. Called AIR from the Anthrax album Spreading the Disease. Scott Ian, founder of Anthrax, is with me here in the Soundcheck studio. His book's called I'm the Man, the Story of That Guy from Anthrax. Cover photo featuring Scott's famous beard. When did you start growing the beard?
I've had something on my chin since 86. Like, photo evidence supports that. I actually, at some point a few years ago, I actually saw, like, looking back at old photos, and it was in 86, actually, is the first time I saw. I used to have one that grew from my lip, from my bottom lip, and it went from there down. And then at some point, it changed, and I got rid of it up here, and I just started growing it from underneath.
From the chin, yeah.
I've had something on my face since 1986.
And how much care, daily care, do you have to give this thing?
Other than the pain in the ass of having to shave around it, that's really it. I wash it and I condition it when I'm in the shower, you know, just so it doesn't smell. Like, that's about it. I forget it's there most of the time. You know?
Does it surprise you when people say, oh, the beard, you know?
Yeah, because I forget it's there, you know? It's not like something I'm always conscious of. I think if you'd ask Billy Gibbons, he'd probably be like, yeah, I don't think about my beard all that often. You know, it's just there. It's part
I don't
of
believe
me.
That. I think Billy Gibbons thinks about that beard every day.
maybe he does.
The story of Anthrax is, I mean, there's kind of a, it's hard to keep track of the comings and goings of the play. I mean, you have been in the eye of a storm there, you know, as singers have come and gone, and, you know, there have been sort of many kind of iterations of the band.
But really, like, I've thought about this quite a bit because it's something that people do bring up. And if you break it down to from 1986 until 2014, so what is that, 96, 2000, 28 years? In 28 years, there's been two singers. You know, there's been Joey and John. Joey, John, then Joey back again. And, you know, and then you've got me, Frankie, and Charlie, who've been there that whole time, you know. We're on our third lead guitar player. So it's not that many. Other bands have had way more lineup changes than us.
But what it's just when you change a lead singer. And, you know, every time in the book that happens, it's a fraught process, you know.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
It's horrible because I'm a fan of music, obviously. There are many bands that I'm a fan of that have done that to me as a fan. It's, of course, I take it personally. Case in point, Van Halen, one of my favorite bands of all time. When David was out and Sammy was in, and I love Sammy Hagar, but Sammy Hagar and Van Halen was not for me. It just didn't work for some reason. The way their sound changed, I appreciate it, but I stopped listening to the records until David came back.
Right.
And I love Van Halen and I love Sammy. It just wasn't right for me. That's why, you know, but it worked for them. Commercially, they were bigger than ever when Sammy joined. Those records were massive. So, you know, it worked. They were able to pull it off. And, you know, when we made that change back in 92, when Joey was out and John Bush was in, I mean, you know, we knew what we were getting ourselves into. It's not like we thought this was just going to be a seamless thing and no one's going to care. You know, I'm very well aware of we probably lost 30%, 40% of our fans at that point in time were probably like, nope, not for me. We knew it was going to be an issue, but we survived it. And not only survived it, Sound of White Noise, you know, sold 700-something thousand copies back then, which in one way is a great success, but at the same time, everyone thought it was going to sell 2 million. So it was weird to think that we just sold more records than we'd ever sold on a record, and the label is disappointed. That was a really strange place to be in.
Well, it is a strange business to be in, as you've learned over the years, and a very different business now than it was back in the 90s and the 80s when you were in your heyday.
Yeah.
Nobody sells 700,000 copies of an album now.
I know, now.
Beyonce.
Yeah.
All right, Scott, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
That's a little bit of the song In the End from Anthrax's latest album called Worship Music. Scott Ian's new memoir is I'm the Man, the story of that guy from Anthrax. Up next, a return visit from New York musician Ahmed Jalab. His band Sin Cane has a new album called Mean Love, and they'll play songs from it for us. And later, the heyday of New York graffiti art, captured in a 1981 underground film. We'll talk with the director of Stations of the Elevated later on Soundcheck.
I'm Linnea from Astoria, New York, and you're listening to Soundcheck from WNYC.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Ahmed Jalab has had a busy year. He directed a musical tribute to the Nigerian synth-funk musician William Onyebor, a collaboration that included folks like David Byrne and Joshua Redman and Def Hines. And Ahmed also released a new album with his own band, Sin Cane. The album's called Mean Love, and today Ahmed Jalab and the band Sin Cane are here with me in the Soundcheck studio, and they're going to play a few songs for us, beginning with this one called How We Be.
The band is Sin Cane, live on Soundcheck, and the song's called How We Be. You'll find that on the latest Sin Cane album, which is called Mean Love. Sin Cane is the work of Ahmed Jalab, who sings, plays keyboards and guitar. Johnny Lamb is here playing guitar and a bit of pedal steel. Michael Ish Montgomery playing the bass, and Jason Trammell ensconced behind our drum kit. Ahmed, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me again, John.
I love the video to this song, How We Be.
It's a great one, isn't it?
It's on our website, soundcheck.org. Check it out to see how many different styles of dancing you recognize and how many different locations around New York City.
Yeah.
So you got, like, all kinds of dancers. Ballet, you know, break dancers, mm-hmm. step dancing, a couple of guys doing something that looks a little bit like parkour.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty amazing. Yeah, Nick, who directed the video, really captured the essence of the song. When we were writing the song, me and my co-producer, Greg LaFaro, we were talking about entering the record really confidently, you know, and talking about something that was really positive, you know, being confident and, you know, owning it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we really wanted to come out with a video that had that same vibe and that really projected that energy.
So it's the lead-off track on the album, and the video has all this incredible dancing. And there you are, busting a move or two.
Trying. It's, you know, I'm doing my best, but, you know, smokes and mirrors.
What's your métier? What's your dance style?
You know, I the Sin Cane style, I guess. I don't know. I'll make it up. I don't know.
It's kind of appropriate, though, given all the different musical styles that come together on this record. There's a great reggae song. There's another mm-hmm. song that has the sounds of Brazilian Tropicália, mm-hmm. the sounds of country western. And this song, I mean, I mentioned that you've been the music director of this William Onyebor project.
Yep.
There's a little of his sound in these songs as well.
Yeah, he's a huge influence. What I really like about him is that he was able to make music that's distinctly African, but the vibe of the music really transcends the idea of it being only African music, you know. And I really enjoy that, and I try to bring that into my music as well.
Now, most people still don't know who William Onyebor is, mm-hmm. and that's by design. I mean, he became a born-again Christian. He refused to acknowledge his own work, talk about it, whatever. But here was a guy who in the 70s was living in Nigeria and mm-hmm. was clearly listening to, like, Kraftwerk and you know, the new wave bands out of England and stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And, you know, the music is still ahead of its time. The fact that he did that all himself as well is really, really fascinating. And people are trying to do it just like he did it back in the late 70s, and they're not even getting close to what he's accomplished. It's pretty amazing.
So so you are the music director of the Onyebor project,
mm-hmm.
which is attempting to sort of spread the gospel of William Onyebor's music.
We're getting close.
Yeah. And I know you've talked about him on Soundcheck in the past. But the idea that this album is about more than just the usual kind of pop song material, you mm-hmm. know, that there are songs here about culture, about mm-hmm. home, yep. about being rooted or being uprooted.
Yep, absolutely. You know, the idea of a love song became kind of tired to me and to Greg as well, who helped me.
What a hard-hearted person you must be, Ahmed.
Well, there's just so many of them, you know? Like, there's so many of them, you know, and you can listen to
that's true.
And honestly, there are a lot, there's so many that are better than what I could come up with, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of love and the essence of love is really amazing. And so we wanted to take that idea of love and the essence of love and kind of reappropriate it to other things, you know. And ultimately, I'm trying to make universal music. So the topics that we were talking about are very personal to me, but are universal to people all over the world. So they can listen to these songs and have their own interpretations and relate to them. And the record can be their own record as well.
Mm-hmm. So the decision to incorporate sounds from the Caribbean, from South America, from East and West Africa, mm-hmm. is that all tied in with this kind of universality that you're going for?
Yeah, absolutely. I also had this kind of a epiphany, this really interesting idea to bring together African music, country western music, soul music, and reggae music. And I did my research, and I looked back at the people, who started creating this music, and it seemed like they all came from the same place, you know. They were all dealing with struggle and oppression, and they had the same sense of urgency in their music when they made all of their music. So I thought it would be really neat to bring all of these ideas together that were rooted and grounded in the same kind of feeling and energy and see what would happen.
Well, let's hear some of those energies in action in this next song. This one's called New Name. It's on the latest Sin Cane album called Mean Love. Why don't we hear a live performance?
Let's do it.
All right. Ahmed Jalib is here with us with the rest of the band Sin Cane. They are playing on Sunday, November 2nd here in New York at SOB's. Here is the band Sin Cane live on Soundcheck. Once again, the band Sin Cane live on Soundcheck with a song called New Name. It is off the latest Sin Cane record called Mean Love. Ahmed Jalib singing, playing keyboard, Johnny Lamb on guitar, Michael Ish Montgomery playing the bass, Jason Trammell playing the drums. Halloween season is coming, and you are doing, with the band, a Beyond the Valley of the Dolls theme show in Austin, Texas.
Beyond the Valley of the Sin Cane.
So is it inspired by the notoriously and wonderfully bad film, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls?
You should see the poster. It's amazing.
Well, the poster has like, you know, it looks like it could actually be the poster for that old movie.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it is. It's really cool. This company called Herd, based out of Austin, Texas, approached us and wanted to do something special for the show. And they came up with the idea, and I'm really excited to see how it kind of plays out.
Have you seen the movie?
I have not seen the movie, actually, embarrassingly enough.
Well, it was written by the late Roger Ebert.
Yeah.
Unbelievably. Because it is truly terrible. So what are you going to go as? I mean, if you haven't seen the movie, I mean, you're going to dress up, right?
We're going to have to have a powwow and think about what we're, because we got to do it collectively.
Right.
So I don't know. I think Jason Trammell, our drummer here, he's going to come up with something.
All right. Okay. Well, you have a little bit of time to work on that.
Jay's seen the movie.
So it's Beyond the Valley of Sin Cain.
Mm-hmm.
Ahmet Jalib and the band Sin Cain are here with us in the studio today and playing this kind of theme show in Austin towards the end of the month, November 2nd at SOB's here in New York. Ahmet, it's always great to see you. Thank you so much for bringing the band in and playing for us today.
Thank you very much, John. We are honored always to come and hang out with you.
Up next, a discussion with the director Manny Kirchheimer about his 1981 film Stations of the Elevated. We'll talk with him about documenting New York's subway graffiti culture at its peak and soundtracking the film with music by Charles Mingus. That's next. Join me for a special soundcheck Halloween pre-party with the band Primus. Les Claypool and the band will join us to play new songs inspired by the 1971 film Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. So come enjoy the music and come in a Willy Wonka-inspired costume. It's all happening October 30th at 1 p.m. It's a special afternoon show. For details and tickets, go to wnyc.org/thegreenspace. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In the late 1970s, graffiti-covered subway cars were as much a part of the New York City landscape as the Empire State Building. But this art form was mostly despised, criminalized by city officials, erased whenever they could from subway trains, and pretty much ignored by the high art community. But in 1981, a radical filmmaker focused his gaze on graffiti, and it forever changed the way we view that medium. The film is now a cult classic among graffiti artists, and it's called Stations of the Elevated. Set to a soundtrack of mostly Charles Mingus and a little Aretha Franklin, it's a non-narrated documentary and one of the most revealing looks we have into New York City at the time when hip-hop culture was just beginning. It'll be screening for 1 week only at BAM Cinematheque starting on Friday. And the filmmaker, Manfred Kirchheimer, joins me here in the Soundcheck studio. Manny, welcome.
Hi, I'm so glad to be here.
So you were here in New York, obviously, in 1977 when the film was shot. I know it was released in 81. 1977, man, there were a lot of people who were afraid of the subways and who were afraid of the way the subways looked. What did you see in the subways that made you want to make this film?
I didn't recognize it when I went to work in the morning. What happened was that I was a freelancer, so I wasn't always working. And in between jobs, I was part of a food co-op. And I had a car, so once a month, and this was now in the summer when the sun gets up early, I would go to Hunts Point with a partner, and we would take the Cross Bronx Expressway, which has three or four elevated lines crossing it.
Mm-hmm.
And the sun would hit these, either backlighted or otherwise, and they'd be beautiful streams of color. And that's where I recognized what was going on. And I said, gee, you know, there's got to be a film in that.
Were you aware of kind of this was like the real birth of hip-hop culture in New York. Were you aware of that part of it, or was the graffiti just like something that appeared mysteriously in the mornings when you went to work?
I was not aware. I was 47 years old, 30 years older than the kids who were putting on the graffiti. Okay. I was not aware of the music happening. I was not aware, except for things like, you know, like Creedence, like The Clash, like things of that kind.
So this kind of gets to the soundtrack of your film. I mean, there's no narration, so whatever sound we're getting is either captured sound from train yards, from, you know, kids watching the trains go by and talking about, oh, look, there's Slave. You know, the Slave is one of the tags on the side of the car. Everyone's an art critic. Even the kids, you know, in the tenements watching the subways go by.
Absolutely.
It's pretty funny. But the, you know, the most of the sound that we hear is Charles Mingus. So was he just a favorite of yours? Did he somehow fit the rhythm of the images?
He certainly fit the rhythm. What happened was that I was looking for a score. Since I wasn't familiar with rap, and I was criticized for this later, I thought that it needed a jazz score, and it needed angry jazz, because a lot of what was happening was angry. And I felt, in my interpretation of the graffiti and of the burnt-out Bronx and stuff like that. So I discovered, in going through records, I discovered Charles Mingus. I was not someone who knew him very well. And I bought all of his records, and I listened. He had died a half a year before. Mm-hmm. And I swiped, stuff off that, because Mingus didn't follow that pattern. Mingus would invent a song, and Fables of Phorbis, for example, and it would be a complete piece from beginning to end.
Right, he would through compose it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And beautifully played, with beautiful tune and angry.
Yeah.
Much of the time.
Yeah.
So, of course, when I needed something uplifting at the end, I had to turn to Aretha Franklin, mm-hmm. Doing Amazing Grace.
Well, it's an unexpected soundtrack to Manfred Kirchheimer's film Stations of the Elevated, but it really works, especially, you know, pieces like Haitian Fight Song. They're in the film for like 10 seconds before you realize, oh, I'm listening to music now. Which is a really neat trick. This is one of the songs from Manny's film, Stations of the Elevated. Charles Mingus's Haitian Fight Song. That is one of the Mingus tracks used in Manfred Kirchheimer's film Stations of the Elevated, which originally was released in 1981 and is showing at BAM Cinematheque for 1 week only, beginning Friday the 17th, running through October 23rd. It's a 45-minute kind of wordless exhibition of tagged subway cars rumbling through the Bronx and Brooklyn, and you know, the graffiti on the outside of the cars is beautiful. Often the graffiti is tagged with further graffiti, which is kind of funny. Why revisit this film today? What is, you know, what's happening today that makes this kind of relevant again?
Well, that's a question that's dogging me. I mean, I don't know. You could say, okay, nostalgia. Well, why didn't that happen 10 years ago? You know, the graffiti stopped in 1989. They finally figured out a way to use steel trains, and because during the time when they were cleaning it, during the time of the graffiti, none of their chemicals worked. They would, you know, back then before the stainless trains, the trains were all painted trains,
mm-hmm.
So it would remove the undercoating as well, and so nothing worked until then. So then there wasn't. I have no idea why. You know, life is bland, you know, and there's a nostalgia for a little grit. But that's pure speculation.
Well, can I introduce a little speculation of my own into
sure.
the conversation? If you take the Times Square shuttle, very often those trains are wall-to-wall, inside and out, advertisements for an upcoming movie or you know, a new brand of vodka or whatever it is, the whole train. So we've gotten to a point where, as you say, they've got the stainless cars, they're graffiti resistant. So what do? They turn the whole thing into an ad. And it kind of, in a weird way to me, reminded me of going to high school in the 70s in New York in subway cars where I couldn't see out the window because they had been painted over with graffiti. And, you know, so I think maybe there's people are feeling a little resonance for that old art form because of the new, quote-unquote, art form of advertising having taken over the subways.
Well, how do they know about the old art form?
Well, a lot of us lived through it.
Oh, I see. You mean people who lived through it, people who knew it then, who saw that there was
the cranky old people like me, man.
Yeah,
In my day,
and me.
We couldn't see out of the subway cars.
Well, I'm not sure.
The film Stations of the Elevated premiered at the New York Film Festival in 1981, and it's running for 1 week only at BAM Cinematheque beginning on Friday. Manny, let me just finally ask you about the title, because Stations of the Elevated, there are so many kind of layers of possible pun and meaning there. You know, elevated trains, you shot it all outdoors, elevating the art form, the Stations of the Cross, you know, for Christians. I mean, where did that title come from for
you? Yes, well, Stations of the Cross. There's a church on the east side in the, I believe, in the 80s or 70s. That has oil paintings of all 14 stations. And I looked at them, and I thought, well, you know, here's something also making a road, going on a road, and, of course, passing many literal stations, but also stopping for people to see, and with many different live souls, as it were, on the trains, you know, as opposed to the book Dead Souls, but... Google. However, it's not towards the cross. It's towards the elevation of these kids, right? These kids are surrounded, we're talking about teenagers from poor neighborhoods who are surrounded by junk of all kinds and by advertising of all kinds of everything but themselves. And here they suddenly found a way to advertise themselves, to get up, as they used to say. And so they're the elevated ones.
Manfred Kirchheimer is the filmmaker. The movie is Stations of the Elevated, showing at BAM Cinematheque, opening on Friday the 17th, 1 week only. And we'll end the way the film ends with Aretha Franklin singing Amazing Grace. And Manny, a real pleasure revisiting this film, which I think I saw, you know, back in 81 at that film festival. And great to have it available for people again. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, it was so nice to be here. Thanks, John.
Tomorrow on the show, 2004 was a monumental year for indie rock, with landmark albums released that year by Arcade Fire, TV on the Radio, The Killers, and William Shatner?
Yes, 2004 was the year that Captain Kirk gave us an oddball release called Has-Been. With some help from musician Ben Folds, we'll look back at it. Plus, Marco Benevento composed Soundcheck's theme song, and he'll join us tomorrow to play songs from his new album, Swift, live in our studio. We're going to leave you tonight with a little more music from tonight's musical guest, Sin Cane. Here's the band playing the title track from their new album, Mean Love, in the Soundcheck studio.
Just cause you show.
Ahmed Jalab and his band Sin Cane playing their song Mean Love. And you can hear this full session in our studio. You can download it from soundcheck.org or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.